Blog Talk Radio.
And good day and a happy Monday from Fairfax, Virginia, where it's slowly clearing after a very stormy night. This is Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham. Within the context of American military history, there are a lot of battles that we like to point to over the centuries that we call epic or great victories. But there's one that kind of stands alone because most Americans, frankly, don't know about it. And that is something called the Battle of Midway. Despite its innocuous name and, in fact, innocuous location where it took place, which is in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, literally the very middle of the Pacific Ocean between San Francisco and Tokyo, Midway was and remains America's greatest naval victory on the order of a Trafalgar or an Armada, if that title of victory rings a bell. So the fact that Americans don't know a lot about it, rarely even think about it, and yet here it is, the greatest thing our Navy ever did, is one of the reasons today we're going to spend the whole hour talking about the Battle of Midway. And to join us, we have perhaps one of my oldest friends here in the area, the man, in fact, who once upon a time actually enticed me 30 years ago to go ahead and start writing and help me get my very first professional article published with Naval Institute Proceedings, Dr. Tom Hone. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can do that very well. And welcome to the show, Tom. Now, obviously, as I said, you and I go back a long way, and obviously your, and equally obviously, your interest in the U.S. Navy goes back a bit. Talk about when you first became interested in naval history and more, maybe more importantly, the structure and evolution of the U.S. Navy.
Well, that interest began many years ago when I was teaching at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. I found some very interesting materials on Navy expenditures, that is, how the Navy spent the money that was allocated to it by the Congress of the United States. And that got me interested then in how the Navy built its force. And, of course, because my information was from the years in the 1920s and 30s, then I went on to look at how that force was used and how it changed in World War II. So it goes way back. I actually, the year probably was about 1975 when I started thinking about this. And I've sort of maintained an interest in it ever since, and that interest has led to research and publications and positions teaching at the Naval War College.
Speaking of that, tell us a little bit about yourself. What is you have been around the Navy, sometimes inside of it, sometimes outside of it, but you've been around the Navy for decades. Just give us a little quick thumbnail of what you've done in the past three or four decades regarding the Navy, the Department of Defense, and such.
Well, I started working for the Navy really as a contractor back in the early 1980s, and I worked then for an organization called Op 96, in the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. It was a fascinating organization at that time with some very wonderful and bright officers in it, and they were looking at the request of the current of the then CNO, Admiral Thomas Hayward. They were looking down the road over a generation to see what the Navy would look like in the 21st century. And I joined that group of people who were undertaking that task. I did that. When that was over, I went over to work as a contractor for the Naval Air Systems Command. When that finished up, I went up to the Naval War College to teach for a year and a half. I came back from that, decided that I didn't want to do work for the Defense Department anymore and that I wanted to be a consultant to private industry. Well, I did that for a while and then discovered that I didn't enjoy that nearly as much as I did working for the Navy. So I went back in various ways to do that. Ended up in the early 1990s as a consultant or as a special assistant to Commander of the Naval Air Systems Command. Then again, I jumped, went over to Europe to help clean up the Cold War and again came back in to work for the Navy, and then went up to work for the Secretary of Defense, for Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. So I sort of went in and out of various Navy positions, either as a person in that position as a government employee or as a contractor. And I learned a great deal. The Navy is a fascinating organization, and there's never a time when there isn't something to learn.
Good advice on all matters of life, no doubt. Now, go ahead.
No, that's true, and I've had the good fortune to be able to publish some of these things. That is, I've been able to look at various portions of the Navy's history, and I've found an outlet for the research articles I've published and the books that I've been involved in, and that has been a pleasure as well.
Now, you've written for Proceedings, for Naval War College Review. What kinds of subjects have you touched on in your writing in periodicals so far?
Oh, well, I've touched on naval history, I've touched on Navy policy, I've touched on defense organization, whatever happened to interest me at the time. So, for example, I spent a few years at the Defense Acquisition University teaching acquisition policy. And I got very interested in that and very interested in where current acquisition practices came from, and I traced them back to World War II, dug through a lot of the records, and published some articles on that. And again, I found that fascinating because quite often people today don't know where the agendas of their organizations came from. They know what their work is, but they don't know why it's their work in some cases. And so I was very interested in the acquisition process and studied it as intently as time allowed, and then published some papers on it.
Now, you, over the past couple of years, have done quite a bit of writing work with the Naval Institute Press, including you did a book on the development of the U.S. Navy in the interwar years between World War I and World War II, correct?
Yes, I did. And that was interesting as well. Again, looking at the roots of the Navy and also how the Navy changed between World War I and World War II.
There's been something of a renaissance lately with people like you and Al Nofi discussing the development of the U.S. Navy during the 1920s and 30s. How has this helped everybody else's overall understanding of how we went into World War II and how we fought it initially in the first year or so of the war?
John, one of the things I discovered is I did research, I mean detailed research, in places like the National Archives and the Navy's Operational Archives. One of the things I discovered was that a lot of what people think they know about the history of an institution like the Navy or about military history is a kind of mythology. And not necessarily the detailed truth. And what I try to do is get down into the details. I always say to people, the devil is in the details, and you have to get down there and look at them. And one of the things that I discovered, along with others, is that the U.S. Navy had some very interesting ways of preparing for World War II. And both the U.S. Navy and its primary opponent, which was the Imperial Navy of Japan, both of these navies understood that they had to plan before the war to go to war. If war came, they had to have plans in hand. They couldn't wait to do the planning then. And it's interesting to look at the year 1942 as a year in which those plans were applied. They're put into action. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Sometimes one Navy is quick to realize that what it planned to do is not working out. Sometimes the Navy refuses to recognize that the initial plan was not the correct one. So it's kind of fascinating. You watch people develop organizations to do the planning. You watch the officers do the plans. You even look at some of the plans that were done. And then you go to the actual wartime history and take a look at how it all worked out.
And we'll do that in just a second for our listeners. If you want to call in, talk to Tom, myself, or both of us, please feel free. The call-in number is 347-945-7246. And we will take your calls if you pop on in. Now, Tom, I talked earlier at the very top of the show about the idea that out there is the Battle of Midway, and yet not a lot of people know about the Battle of Midway. What is it? When did it occur? Where did it occur? And give us 50 words on why it is America's greatest and most important naval victory.
All right. I'll do the last first. Midway.
Fair enough.
Such a critical victory because up until that time, that is the first week of June 1942, the Imperial Navy of Japan was triumphant across one-third of the globe, from Hawaii to the Bay of Bengal. They had the initiative. They were pushing. They were defeating the opponents that came up against them. This whole triumphant passage of the Imperial Navy across the Pacific was stopped abruptly at Midway in the first week of June 1942. And from that time on, it was the U.S. Navy that had the initiative. It was the U.S. Navy that was pushing. It was the U.S. Navy that was going to turn the Japanese victory into ultimately a Japanese defeat.
And so you're talking about the United States Navy in the minds, and at least in the mythology of the time, crippled at Pearl Harbor, eroded during the drive through the Java barrier down to Australia, suddenly just stopping this juggernaut, the greatest overwater offensive in the history of mankind, dead in its tracks. And not just in the sense that they sank a lot of ships and did other things, but just stopped it literally in a day, correct?
Yes, that's basically how it happened. In one day, the Imperial Navy of Japan lost four of its finest aircraft carriers and a number of pilots and air crew, and lost even more the men on those carriers who took care of the airplanes, who put the ordnance on them, the mechanics, all the rest. So there was this very excellent force the Japanese had, powerful six carriers when they started the war at Pearl Harbor, down to four carriers by Midway, but it was still a collection of probably the finest naval carrier air force on Earth. And it was suddenly and utterly defeated at Midway.
And we have a caller, appears to be from the area of Oxnard, California. Let's bring him on. Talk to us. You're on Military Monday. Hello? Well, I guess they're not there. Now, Tom, this was no accidental victory. This was something that had been planned by the Japanese for at least a few months, and we'll talk more about that. And the Americans managed to go ahead and virtually in the nick of time develop the intelligence understanding of the Japanese plan and put in place a classic head 'em off at the pass ambush. Talk a little bit about how that happened, and we're going to start. I'm going to set you on the road to that by saying on April 18th, 1942, Jimmy Doolittle did a very, very exciting thing and got the Japanese attention. I'll let you take it from there.
Well, what happened on April 18th, 1942 was that Doolittle's B-25 Army bombers launched from an aircraft carrier, the USS Hornet. They actually bombed Tokyo and other Japanese cities. They didn't do that much damage. But Admiral Yamamoto, the commander-in-chief of Japan's combined fleet, said that he would never allow the Americans to bomb Tokyo in that way. And so when that attack took place, it meant that Yamamoto had to rethink his approach to protecting the home islands of Japan. He had a kind of defense perimeter around the islands, but he wanted to push it farther toward the United States so that there would be no surprise attacks on the home islands of Japan. Now, the problem Yamamoto faced was that he needed lots of carriers and lots of airplanes. And when he started the war, he had this six-carrier force, very effective, very well-trained, experienced in the war with China. He had that six-carrier force, and he needed to use it all over the Pacific and the Indian Oceans, from Hawaii to the Bay of Bengal. And the problem was he needed to have it in multiple places at almost the same time, and he couldn't do it. So that was a kind of operational level weakness, and the United States Navy took advantage of it. Well, how? By ambushing his carrier force under Vice Admiral Nagumo at Midway. Nagumo wanted to ambush the Americans. The Americans ambushed him, and as you said, they were able to do so because they understood where he would be and when he would arrive to attack Midway itself. So both sides are looking to ambush the other side, and that's because both sides don't have many carriers. So the side that gets in the first shot is probably the one that's going to win the battle and win it decisively, not just with sinking one or two carriers, but maybe sinking everything. Carrier battles at this stage of the war are like playing roulette. You go in, you put a lot of money down, your chances of victory are slim unless you can get a surprise on the other side.
And how was it that the Americans, under a crusty Texan by the name of Chester Nimitz as the commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, how did Nimitz know where to put his money, or in this specific case, his carriers?
Yeah, he had been given very accurate intelligence on the Japanese intentions, and that had come from communications intelligence. And I use those two words together, communications and intelligence, because the 14th Naval District, which was, of course, Hawaii, the 14th Naval District had the people who intercepted Japanese communications and deciphered those that were in code and translated them from the Japanese language into English. They were very, very effective, and they had hunches about what the Japanese might do, and they had been searching through messages to see if their sense of what was going to happen was in fact what the Japanese were planning. And they discovered that they did understand. And then they worked with the intelligence officers on Nimitz's staff to convince the admiral that they were right. Remember, these were the people who had not predicted the attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941. But they had gotten better and smarter by the spring of 1942, and they were very able in providing Nimitz with the kind of knowledge that he needed to put his carriers in the right place. It's all a matter of ambush. And Nimitz was able to put his carriers in a place where they could ambush the Japanese.
Okay, we have another caller. Let's see if we can get this one. Looks like it's from Washington, D.C. And caller, are you there?
I am. This is Dwayne calling from Washington.
Yes, Dwayne. What would you like to talk about?
So I've got two questions, and I'll do the quick one first, which is I'd like to know, how do the Japanese actually cover this in terms of history? Are there any good books in Japan? How do they look at this victory? And then the second question, which is probably a little more complex, is overall, what is the balance between careful planning and good resources like the intelligence intercepts and all of that, compared to just sheer luck in the American victory?
Thank you for your questions. I'm going to let Tom Hohen answer these. Tom, talk to the man.
I'll take them in sequence. I don't know of any one book in Japan, and because I don't read Japanese, I may have missed it, but I don't know of any one book that really goes through what happened at Midway carefully. There are some very good books in English. There's one that's based on contacts and interviews with a lot of Japanese. It's a book called Shattered Sword by two authors, Jonathan Parshall and Anthony Tully, and it was published in 2005. It gives the best account that exists of the Japanese side. But it's interesting that the Japanese people have not sort of approached World War II the way that some of their enemies would like to see them do it, more the Chinese than the United States. And this is an issue of irritation between the governments of China and Japan. I don't know how that will turn out. But I do know that after the Battle of Midway, the Emperor of Japan, Emperor Hirohito, clamped down on any information that might be given to the Japanese public about this defeat. And in fact, the Japanese Navy didn't tell the Japanese Army exactly what had happened. They hid information from them. So there's a tradition that goes back to the war of not facing up to some things. And I think it still exists. I'm puzzled by it, but I think it still exists. Now, the second question was, what's the difference between training and luck? Well, you know the old phrase, that if you do your training and planning well, then you create your own luck. And I think that's what you have to say in answer to that question. If the training hadn't been there, if it hadn't been good, if it hadn't been rigorous, then the U.S. Navy would not have been able to take advantage of the breaks that came its way. It's all a matter of can you take advantage of the breaks. And the U.S. Navy was able to do so because it was well-trained and because it had a very good idea of what it wanted to do. That doesn't mean there weren't mistakes. There are always mistakes in war. You know, the phrase the fog of war is one that I think most people have heard. But you have to have the training in order to take advantage of any breaks that come your way. And the U.S. Navy had that training.
Obviously, you just described the difference there between training and opportunity slash luck. And certainly the Japanese had very crack people, both flying their airplanes, driving their ships, doing maintenance. All of that is something that the Japanese had emphasized prior to the war. But a lot of people don't know the United States Navy was no slack when it came to training, exercises, and just getting out on the ocean and steaming and knowing how to go and operate at sea, correct?
Clearly. Both navies, that of Japan and that of the United States, did not forward deploy before World War II. The Japanese Navy had a lot of experience in China. Japanese aviators flew missions for over three and a half years into China before World War II with the United States broke out. But neither Navy routinely forward deployed the way the U.S. Navy does today. So they had to use exercises as a substitute for what they thought would happen during the war. Both sides did that. Both sides learned, for example, that if you didn't have a lot of carriers and if you didn't really have something like effective radar, then your carriers could be caught by surprise and eliminated quickly by the other side. It was as though the combatants on both sides, the forces on both sides, were like two men with very sharp knives in a very dark room. And the guy who found the other guy first was probably going to be the one who won. They had learned that before the war, and that's certainly what we see during the war. And it was no surprise to either Navy.
I've once heard it said those early carrier duels in 1942 were like a couple of hemophiliacs in a dark room, as you said, slashing at each other with gas-powered chainsaws because they had huge and enormous offensive potential, but fire, flooding, and other things made them very vulnerable at the time as the new art of damage control was still being learned on both sides.
Well, damage control for carriers, John, that's the key. Carriers then were floating volcanoes. They had a lot of ordnance. They had to have that because you need a lot of bombs and torpedoes and so on. And they also had high-octane gasoline for the piston engines of their aircraft. So it was always a possibility that rupturing a gasoline line could fill a ship with gasoline fumes, and then they could detonate. That's what led to the loss of the United States Navy's carrier Lexington at the Battle of Coral Sea. Lexington had been torpedoed twice, but she was a very big ship, well protected, and the two holes done by the torpedoes in her side were not the things that sank her. It was the spread of gasoline vapor through the interior of the ship, and then the ignition of that vapor in a catastrophic explosion.
So, we're coming up on June 1942, and Admiral Yamamoto has brought out pretty much the whole Imperial fleet. What does he throw at Midway, and how does he throw it?
Well, he actually has two forces to throw at Midway. First is the four carriers in the carrier task force. I think you pronounce it Kido Botai, which is the Japanese reference.
Battle force, yes.
Battle force. And then there is the invasion force that is coming along with the soldiers and Japanese Marines who will actually assault Midway. They are accompanied by supply ships bringing aircraft that can be used on Midway's airfields once the Japanese Marines and soldiers have taken the islands, the two islands there that form the Midway Atoll. So there are two primary forces. One is an invasion force and the other is this attack force. But you have to understand that Admiral Yamamoto's grand design was to use Midway as bait to bring out what was left of the U.S. Navy, and then he was going to crush that. And the assumption was that if he could really defeat the U.S. Navy, for example, knock out the three remaining carriers, if he could do that, then he could force the United States to sign an armistice with Japan, recognizing most of the Japanese conquests.
And, of course, behind this was the battle force under Yamamoto of big battleships and, of course, a side expedition to the north to go ahead and grab islands in the Aleutians. So it was a massive movement, correct?
Yes, it was. As you said, it was most of the Japanese battle fleet was in motion, and some were up in the Aleutians. Some were actually attacking Midway, those two forces that I mentioned. Yamamoto was behind the carrier force. So the Japanese fleet is spread out over a very large area. And what Yamamoto wanted to be able to do was to coordinate the movement of the different ships so that when the time came, they could pull together and decisively defeat any force sent against him by the United States Navy.
Okay, it's June 1942, and you are Chester Nimitz, the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. What have you got left, and what are you going to deploy to try and stop the Japanese at Midway?
Well, what both navies had learned before World War II was that you needed carrier decks. You didn't have many carriers when the war started. Neither navy did. And they had to preserve those carriers as best they could. The Japanese preserved theirs initially through offensive action. You know, you put six carriers together, you have a lot of aircraft in the air, you have 300 airplanes up in the air, and you gain air superiority and then attack the ships of the other side. So the Japanese had this notion of how they would proceed. Nimitz had to figure out how to stop it. And there were two keys to that. First, the three carriers, U.S. carriers that were left, Enterprise, Yorktown, and Hornet, and also Midway itself, which you could think of as a stationary carrier. So if you look at the numbers of aircraft on the two sides, the advantage actually goes to the U.S. side. But the training advantage, the experience advantage, goes on the Japanese side. The Japanese had learned how to coordinate airstrikes from multiple carriers. They were very effective at this. Actually more effective than the U.S. Navy. So if you're Admiral Nimitz, you sit there and say, what do I have? I've got three carriers. I've got Midway. I can reinforce Midway. The Army Air Forces will fly B-17s up there and so on. We can bring planes from Hawaii up to Midway because it's only about 1,100 miles from Hawaii to Midway. So you've got these forces, but you have to use them wisely because you've been directed by Admiral King, who's Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet, not to throw the carriers away, not to lose them because they're critical through 1942 until the new carriers start showing up later in 42 and certainly in 1943 and 44. So Nimitz has a limited number of cards to play, and he has to make sure he gets the most out of all his assets, his limited numbers of carriers, cruisers, and destroyers.
And on top of which, he has one other limitation, what he perceives to be his best and most aggressive admiral, Admiral Halsey, is suddenly thrown in the hospital with what essentially is dermatitis after six brutal months of running around the Pacific doing everything from raids, including the Tokyo raid, to decoying the Japanese. And who has he got left to lead his carriers with Bill Halsey in the hospital?
Well, he has two people left. He has Admiral Fletcher, who was in command at Coral Sea, and he has Admiral Spruance, who, though a surface officer, today he'd be called service line officer, had experience with Admiral Halsey and knew a great deal, surprisingly, to some at least, a great deal about aviation, about naval aviation and how to use it. Also, Spruance inherits Halsey's staff. Halsey's the only one in the hospital. His staff is still there. You know, you've studied these things, and I've worked on staffs. If the staff is working along, you can get a new flag officer especially one that's thoughtful and sensitive about these things. You get a new flight officer in there, and that individual can tap the energy and expertise that's in the staff. So Nimitz had two very excellent flight officers, Fletcher and Spruance, and they performed very, very well at Midway.
Let's start and just talk for a minute about Jack Fletcher. A lot of people don't know, Medal of Honor recipient for action during the Veracruz expedition.
Right, 1914.
Background in destroyers, had commanded during Coral Sea, and while he had made his share of mistakes, he didn't lose the battle, and maybe more importantly, brought Yorktown home and brought home a whole lot of experience that was gained in those in that game of blind man's bluff down north of Australia, correct?
Yes, he did. And there's a wonderful book about him by the naval, military historian, because he does more things than naval history, John Lundstrom, and a very fascinating book about Admiral Fletcher, his background, his activities at Coral Sea and Midway, and then later his commands in the battle around Guadalcanal, starting in August and September 1942.
And this is a man who was perhaps one of the more selfless admirals. He never allowed his ego to get in the way of making sure that America won a battle, or at least didn't lose it. I mean, genuinely underappreciated.
I think so, and that's why John Lundstrom wrote the book. Lundstrom said, if you look at the post-World War II histories, Fletcher tends to get ignored. And Lundstrom wrote a book to show what really happened. And I'm very glad he did. It's a very wonderful book. And Fletcher was one of those people who, very professional, very dedicated, very hardworking, had to soldier on, if you want to use that term, through the opening months of World War II, when the people who were commanding aircraft forces in the United States Navy were learning. They were trying to learn. And it's Fletcher who sort of gets the carrier forces over that initial hump. Because if you go on another year from 1942 to June 1943, now the carrier forces of the United States Navy are on the verge of developing new and better doctrine. They're getting newer equipment, newer airplanes, and they are putting together a powerful offensive force, not one that has to hide from the enemy, but one that can go up against it, even land-based aircraft. So it's that's the time. The Navy needs about a year, a little more than a year, to evaluate experience, to survive the initial battles, and then to build up a force that could really destroy the Japanese. And you see this in the Battle of the Philippine Sea in 1920, June 1944. The Japanese have both land-based and carrier-based aircraft. They lose 92% of them to the American carrier-based forces. 92% of their aircraft. It's absolutely extraordinary. And it is the result of that learning that was done after Midway, after Guadalcanal. And the admiral who got the carrier forces through that was Admiral Fletcher.
And then there's Ray Spruance, who, frankly, if you are a naval historian and you've ever read about the United States Navy, you just want to hold him up like a shiny penny. He was, when it came to that kind of business, he was our warrior. He was just a formidable intellect when he was
also
in command of a force.
Yeah, he was a formidable intellect, but he was also a human being. And he was concerned after Midway that maybe he had made some incorrect decisions. For example, the first day of the battle, the key day, which is June the 4th, that's when the Japanese lose four carriers. But at that time, the U.S. Navy thought that there was another one out there, and the U.S. Navy wasn't certain for sure that all those four Japanese carriers had been lost. So you get to the nighttime. Now what do you do? You know, it's nighttime. Carrier airplanes aren't going to go out and attack at night. There aren't that many of them left. So Spruance decides to leave the scene of the battle, to go east, away from the Japanese. Then in the early morning hours, he turns west to go back so that his aircraft that remain can be active in fighting before dawn, just before dawn. That was That was U.S. Navy doctrine. If you look at the Fleet Tactical publications, that's what they said. Carriers should get out of the way of surface ships at night. They should not get caught by surface ships. And Spruance took his ships to the east, then went back to the west. And sure enough, the Japanese had put together a force and were going to try to run down his carriers at night with battleships and cruisers. So, you know, he went, he did the right thing, but he wasn't sure, because there were a lot of things that weren't understood at that time. The other side, the Japanese side, was not understood well by the U.S. Navy. And so that uncertainty bothered him for a long time.
Not something he needed to worry about. He never made the big mistake in battle throughout an entire war, which is something that's very rare, even with the best of commanders.
Yeah, he never did. And he epitomizes, I think, the solid, thoughtful, professional, committed to his field of endeavor, and willing to learn what he had to learn in order to accept a new kind of command, a carrier command. It's really an extraordinary achievement, and it's one that Spruance kept to himself. He was quiet, and yet at the same time very intelligent, and very direct, and very forthright. So people would argue with him, he would accept that, but they understood that he had his authority by right. That is, he was good at what he did.
Let's talk for 1 second, before we go on to talking a little about your book, about the people under Spruance. And I'm talking about the sailors, the officers, the pilots. We talk about just how often we hear how good the Japanese were. And you pointed out some of these guys had 3 years fighting in China before, of course, they got their last generation of new aircraft before World War II and were crack pilots. But there were some pretty good and smart people driving airplanes for the U.S. Navy at that point. Now, let's talk about a couple of them. Let's throw a couple of names out there. Let's talk about Wade McCluskey, Jimmy Thatch, and Dick Best.
Well, these are interesting characters because they're all good pilots. Best had been a fighter pilot, and he had to switch over to lead dive bombers and did very well at Midway. He's the officer who, flying ahead of the aircraft behind him, the other dive bombers, he's the one who looked down, saw a Japanese destroyer, which had been keeping down the United States submarine Nautilus with depth charging. He saw that destroyer hightailing it back toward the Japanese carrier force. Best looked at that and said, that's got to be where they are. So off he went. And I think it's Best. Is it Best or McCluskey?
That's McCluskey, and then Best was the bombing sixth commander behind him.
Yeah. It's what's impressive about these individuals is that, again, they are real professionals. And, you know, you go back in the history of the United States Navy and ask yourself, why are pilots in the U.S. Navy officers? Why are pilots in the Japanese Navy mostly enlisted personnel? The difference goes all the way back to the beginning of carrier aviation in the United States Navy, when Rear Admiral Moffett, who was chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics all through the 1920s, said that Navy pilots need to be officers because they would have to make command decisions while in the air. They couldn't rely on command decisions from the carriers that sent them out on their missions. They had to be able to make those decisions in the air. And Best, McCluskey, these people made those decisions, got them right. And it's extraordinary testimony to how good younger officers can be when they're faced with the wartime situation with all its uncertainty. They figure it out and they do it. It's wonderful.
Now, we talked earlier about how generally unknown Midway is to the general populace. And this brings up the question of your new book. Now, I should point out this is not something you wrote entirely yourself. Let's talk a little bit about the challenge that you were offered by Naval Institute Press to do this book, and what was the intention of this book?
The Naval Institute Press approached me and said, could you edit an anthology of material that was under the control of the Naval Institute, that the Naval Institute had published, either in journal like the Naval Institute Proceedings or their Naval History Magazine or in book form. And they said, can you put this together and so that we have a collection of things on Midway that people will find useful? And my answer was, sure, I'll do that, because I think there was a – I thought then, I think now, there still is a need for that. Also, Midway is one of the two – the Battle of Midway, June 4th, is one of two dates that the Navy celebrates or commemorates every year. And I think you know how this works. I'm sure a lot of – if there are any people listening, I'm sure they know this too. Then, when a commemoration approaches, a senior officer says to somebody junior – it's your job. Put something together for the command. Give people a sense of why this matters. Well, I had that in the back of my mind when I pulled all this material together. I had it there so that some young ensign or lieutenant who was told to put something together for the Midway commemoration would have what he or she needed at hand in this book. Also, the Naval Institute has been very good over a period of decades finding, publishing good papers, articles, oral histories, books on Midway and related engagements and campaigns. And so it was a pleasure to go back through that material and pull it together.
You must have had a blast going through all that stuff and having to make the hard decision. Okay, what piece do I grab for this part and what excerpt for that part?
And
of course, what you're dealing with is some of the best material from some of the finest writers of our genre.
Yeah, it was difficult, and I had help from retired Navy Commander Tom Cutler, who was my editor at the United States Naval Institute Press. I had other people who talked to me about it and read or looked at the excerpts that I had selected. But I think what helped me the most was just the quality of the people who were at Midway. A lot of the stuff that had come out showed you not only the Navy at its best, but also just the Navy. And, you know, if you go to this beginning of World War II, most of the sailors in the Navy are people who were already in the Navy before the war began. And these are people who volunteered. They wanted to be there. This was something important to them. And so from, you know, the deck plates on up, if you want to use that phrase, you had people who were dedicated to the mission. And it was a pleasure to go through and read about them, to read some of the things they had said, to read interviews with them. It was a very real pleasure on my part to do that. And in fact, the problem wasn't finding material. The problem was trying to get the length of the book down to something that was reasonable. I actually had about twice as much material as I used. So it had to be. You had to make some hard decisions about what to put in and what to leave out.
Now, how did you organize the book? What were the major sections that you developed to place these excerpts in, and how did they break down?
Well, I decided initially to do it in a kind of chronological order. So the first part is the approach to Midway, some background. So that the reader gets a sense of the two sides, particularly the Japanese side. Why did they want to attack Midway? What was the point? What were their forces like? And then I carry that on into the second part where I start looking at not only the Japanese but also the Americans, what their backgrounds are like and why Midway is going to matter to them. And the third part is the actual battle. And it's really the longest part in terms of the number of selections. What happened? What did it look like? One of the problems with military history or naval history is that if it's something in the past and there are good books about it or good articles, we sit down, we read those, and we know what happened. But we see things differently than the people who were there. So that's what I wanted to capture in that third section. The fourth section was on the end of the battle. You know, what happened after things had sort of finished up? Again, that's an area that a lot of people don't think about, but it was important, very important in this case. And then I had a section on the official report of the battle. Admiral Nimitz had to write with his staff a report to Admiral King, Commander-in-Chief in Washington, had to write a report on what happened at Midway.
And for the record, this is a marvelous document. One of the original copies is held up at the National Archives II facility in College Park. and they will bring it out and let you actually handle it and read it. And it's just an amazing first draft of history to run your hands over it and scan it.
Yeah, it is. And it's very well done. And also, I put it in there as a kind of model. If younger officers or even senior officers want to write a report on an engagement, this is a model. This shows you how to do it and do it very well. Then there's another section on the commanders, both sides, on the U.S. side and the Japanese side. Then a whole section on the code breaking. And there, that was very, very difficult because there's some very good stuff that's been published. But, I had to take a lot of it out just because we didn't have room in the book, because I wanted another section on the assessments of the battle. Now, what do people think of it now? Was it important or not? And I have some very good essays there. Again, these mostly came out of the Naval Institute Proceedings.
Now, we've talked kind of around the core achievement of the battle, the blunting of the invasion of Midway and the sinking of the carriers. Let's talk for the listeners a little bit about what was happening after the Japanese conducted their first morning strike on Midway. They were rearming for a second strike. They had scout planes out, and they've taken a couple of minor strikes from Midway, the land-based aircraft there, and all of a sudden they find the Yorktown. One of their scout planes that was catapulted late finds it. Talk a little bit about what happened and what happened with the American strikes that were headed for them that Spruance had ordered off the deck that morning to try and get that first punch in.
By the time the Japanese knew there was at least one carrier, American carrier, that they needed to attack, by that time, strikes from the other American carriers were already on their way to the Japanese. And if you look at the Japanese plan for the engagement, they assume they will catch the U.S. Navy by surprise. But it's the reverse. And once Vice Admiral Nagumo understands that there is at least one American carrier out there, he knows he's got to attack it. But he's had the crews of the carriers preparing not for a strike on carriers, but for another strike on Midway. So now the question is, what does he do? Does he send airplanes with ordnance for land targets against ships? What does he do? How does he do it? And he has to make a very critical decision. Just soon after he makes that decision, saying rearm the airplanes for the strike on the American ships, soon thereafter, the aircraft from the American carriers are all over him. And his combat air patrol is very good at knocking out the torpedo planes from the U.S. carriers because they have to come in low and slow. But as they come down to defend the carriers, the Japanese carriers against that attack, they leave open the high altitude region, and that's where the dive bombers come from. It's extraordinary. I mean, in 5 minutes, the nature of the battle changes completely.
Three squadrons of Dauntless dive bombers have all converged on Kido Butai with the battle force within just a very short period of time. Two from Enterprise coming up from the south, led by McCluskey, and then another strike led by the great Max Leslie off of the Yorktown.
Yeah.
And what happens in that 5 minutes?
Well, in that 5 minutes, three aircraft, Japanese aircraft carriers, are wrecked. They're wrecked. They're not sunk. They're still afloat, but they're wrecked. They can't operate airplanes. They're on fire. And they eventually have to be destroyed. If one sinks and the other two have to be destroyed by the Japanese themselves. I mean, it just happens so quickly. And before World War II, you can go through certainly the American exercises. I haven't seen any evidence on the Japanese side. But on the American side before World War II, that's what would happen. The attacking aircraft would suddenly show up, and it was extremely difficult to defeat them. If they caught you by surprise, they had you. And that's what happened at Midway. And the Japanese, who were on their own carriers, looking up at these American dive bombers coming down, they knew. They knew that they were lost.
And then, of course, later on June 4th, there's an exchange of airstrikes. Yorktown is hit and crippled at the time. Later was sunk by a Japanese submarine. But the Americans, again, Jack Fletcher makes a great decision, sends out his scouting squadron after he dispatches the first strike led by Max Leslie. They find the last carrier, the Hiryu. And what does Spruance do with the data?
I don't know. You asked me that question again. What are you driving?
Oh,
there's
in other words,
I was thinking of.
Yeah. In other words, Fletcher sends out a scouting squadron to follow up the first strike of the morning. They find what's left of the carrier force of the Japanese, led by Hiryu. And what does Ray Spruance do with the information now that after Yorktown is bombed, he's suddenly in charge of everything?
Well, yeah, he has to execute what was then the existing doctrine, which is to attack.
And he puts a couple of dozen dive bombers in the air. They go out.
Right, that's all he's got left. What I tell people about Midway is that the carriers basically have four squadrons. One, a scouting squadron. These are dive bombers. An attack squadron of dive bombers who usually carry a 1,000-pound bomb. The torpedo planes and the fighters. And the torpedo planes from the U.S. carriers had been decimated in the attack on the Japanese. So what Spruance has left are dive bombers. And he's got planes on Enterprise that had been on Yorktown before she was disabled. So he sends them all off. That was the doctrine because you wanted to have that strong punch. And that would carry you through any Japanese defenses and you'd destroy that last carrier, which is exactly what happened.
And in a day, the United States Navy completely turns the tide of World War II in the Pacific. Just with two punches, they drop the Japanese Navy, and two-thirds of their big carriers are going to the bottom.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And the Japanese never overcome the consequences of that defeat.
Today, the Navy has finally begun to celebrate Midway as well they should. There are Midway dinners that are now held here in Washington and other places and around the nation. Ships at sea celebrate it. And you have now written a book that provides a guide to that battle for the general public to use, as well as the Navy. How do you feel about this particular volume and what it might be able to contribute long term to the world, and particularly for America to finally recognize this great battle for the value that it had in World War II?
Well, the Midway anthology that I put together is a good reference point, a very good starting point, because you get to see all the different facets of the engagement, and it's also a good reminder that there's this fog of war that people may not know for sure what happened until years later. And even years later, they may still not understand. They may still not have all the information that they need to really grasp what went on. I put in the anthology an excerpt. It's actually a presentation by former Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, in which he talks about the strategic impact of Midway. And again, I was very pleased to find that, because it had a strong strategic impact. I always tell people, go back to the spring of 1942, put yourself in the shoes of President Franklin Roosevelt, and ask yourself, okay, how does it look to you? It looks very dangerous in April and May and running up to June. The Japanese are pushing in the Pacific. The United States government has decided that Germany is the primary enemy. The plans are being written up for what became the invasion of North Africa in the fall of 1942. There's a need for a victory. There's a need for a victory to stop the momentum of the Japanese, and Midway is that victory. And it has strong strategic effects.
And it's worth noting that the difference between May and July is that in May and June, we fought two vicious carrier battles, literally to the death kind of battles with Japan. And in July, we decided to go out and invade a strategically important island to stop the expansion from the Japanese there at a little place called Guadalcanal.
Yeah.
Completely different mindset when we go and invade Guadalcanal in August.
Yeah, it is. It's the momentum of the Japanese has been broken, and now it's offensive on the part of the United States, and that's what Guadalcanal shows.
Well, we've talked about Midway, and we've talked about the book. Let's talk a little bit about you, Tom. What are you going to be doing? What else do you have for us in the months and years ahead?
Well, I don't know. I'm retired now. And, you know, I still write. I had an essay published recently in the Naval War College Review, I guess, earlier this year or at the end of last year, on the changes in the structure of the Navy's battle forces in World War II. I may do some more work in that area. I may go back and take a look again at the workings of the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. I already wrote one book on that. I may, you know, do volume two, so to speak. And, you know, I'll just see what comes up. I try to get involved with the Navy as much as the Navy is willing to let me be involved. So just the other day, I was down at the Naval Surface Weapons Center in Dahlgren, Virginia, talking about Midway and Philippine Sea and the battles in World War II as being important to the nature of fleet air defense. Again, I found a lot of the younger engineers didn't have any knowledge of this background, and we had a lot of fun talking about it. So it was my pleasure to do that. So,
and you're going
to
be talking about Midway at other events later this year, of course.
You bet. Yes, I'll get back up to the Naval War College where I taught twice. I'll be up there to talk about Midway. I'll talk about Midway at the operational level of war, that is, the Pacific Theater. You know, other places I've gone to speak, and I'm happy to do that. It's a real pleasure, just as it was a pleasure to do the editing that stands behind the anthology.
And, of course, you're not the only hone out there who's writing. You have a rather prolific son who has followed in your footsteps, both writing and with maritime matters, correct?
Yeah, he's an executive with a software firm, but he also does this writing on the side, and he's very good at it. He's smarter than his old man, and it's always nice to have children who are smarter than you are. they can point to your errors. But it's always been a pleasure to work with him, and he and I may do that again.
It'd be nice to see another collaboration. I remember one of your early ones was building your own little fleet of wooden toy warships back when we first met back in the 80s, and you two have obviously collaborated rather well over the years.
Yeah, he's a very good researcher and really understands how to do research. He's an excellent writer, and he's extremely bright. So it's always a pleasure to work with him. It's a pleasure to work with anybody who has those kinds of characteristics, the combination of creativeness and professionalism is a wonderful combination. And, you know, wherever you find it, it's a pleasure to experience it.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you again for coming and joining us. I want to thank Naval Institute Press for allowing us to talk to you. And I hope we get to have you on the show again sometime when you have something you want to talk about.
Well, Joel, thank you very much. And you were very kind to give me a gracious introduction before we began speaking this afternoon. And I just simply want to say that I have been very proud of all the work that you've done, and you've done an awful lot of it. And it's amazing the output that you've had over the years. And I think you've got a set of fans, of which I am one.
Well, thank you, Tom, and I only can respond by saying it's your fault. you got me into this mess, and I'll get even someday. Listen, Tom, have a great day, and we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
All right. Sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And folks, with that, we're going to close this edition of Military Monday. I hope you'll join us again next week at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, when we're hoping to have Mr. David Isby to talk about the development of present-day special operations forces, not just here in America, but also around the world. And with that, have a great week, take care, and be well.